I don't know which one, and if someone would stand up and identify the group, then we could recognize you. Well, thank you. Won't you all stand so we can recognize you? Thank you, and we are delighted that you include the Supreme Court as part of your study. Please be seated. We have materials outside about the court and the judges and about the room, and you are welcome to take as many as you like, one for each student, etc. And let me introduce to you the court. And on my far left is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And in the empty chair usually sits Justice Steinmetz, but he is recovering from an operation. He will not be participating in this case. Seated to the right of the empty chair is Justice John Wilcox, and on the far right is Justice Patrick Crooks. With those preliminary remarks, we will call the first case, 98-0886-D, in the matter of the disciplinary proceedings against Scott and Selmer, attorney at law, representing Mr. Selmer. Selmer is Scott Herrick, attorney Herrick.
Thank you and good morning. I'm Scott Herrick, attorney for Scott Selmer, the appellant in this matter. Mr. Selmer is present with us in your courtroom this morning with his family. I'm here to argue his appeal from the recommendation of your referee. This case presents a particular convergence of technical procedural issues with substantive content and context of great social importance, not unlike some other Supreme Court matters that come before you. I hope to discuss both aspects of the case and ultimately to persuade this court that Attorney Selmer should prevail on the narrow technical grounds, but in the current procedural posture of the case. The sense in which Attorney Selmer should prevail, and what we seek in this case, is a remand for discovery and hearing before the referee, or alternatively, a remand for discovery, followed by reconsideration by the referee of her summary judgment recommendation, or alternatively, at the very least, remand to the referee to address the request for additional discovery which the referee did not reach in her report and recommendation. I note in the materials on the side table for the public information about the court calendar, the paragraph indicates, in summarizing today's case, that the Supreme Court will review the rulings made by Wisconsin's referee and determine whether they were proper. The court will also decide what discipline to impose on Selmer. I would like to express a reservation about that description of what you're doing today. I'd like to think that you're not going to get to that second question today, but that you will remand the matter as we request to the referee. What are the narrow issues, and what is the substantive context of this appeal? We've identified two narrow technical issues. Let me restate them for you this morning. First, did the referee properly refuse to allow appellant to conduct additional discovery? The referee declined to reach appellant's motion for an extended period of discovery, dated November 5, 1998, thereby implicitly denying the motion. The second narrow issue is, did the Board of Attorneys' Professional Responsibility establish as a matter of law that no further proceedings are required to apply the standards for reciprocal discipline set forth in SCR 22.25, parent 5, parent A, B, and C? What are the broader contextual questions? First, the gravamen of the Minnesota proceedings is the allegation that Attorney Selmer frivolously alleged racial bias against himself in his own defense in civil litigation in cases which had settled without trial prior to the disciplinary proceedings, and in which neither the bias issues nor the more general issue of frivolousness had been raised, let alone decided. The second broader contextual question is this. Attorney Selmer has challenged the propriety of Minnesota prosecutorial practices by alleging that the conduct which gave rise to Selmer's Minnesota suspension not only predated his other discipline, but was actually known to the Minnesota prosecutor during the prosecution of the prior charges for which appellant Selmer had been placed on probation.
Would it make a difference if they didn't know?
With respect to this second question, yes. That is our suggestion that there was a taint to that prosecution. It would make a difference. Let me turn now to those narrow issues. Number one, did the referee properly refuse to allow appellant to conduct additional discovery? I must review a bit of the facts here. I'll try not to go into too much detail. By an order dated May 18, 1998, following a telephonic conference, the referee established a case calendar providing a two-month discovery window and a motion schedule. By letter, dated June 3, 1998, counsel for Attorney Selmer proposed to depose three individuals. Anticipating possible board objection to these depositions, this letter requested extension of the discovery period to allow resolution of the anticipated deposition dispute. The parties exchanged written interrogatories and answers. The board filed its motion for judgment. In August of 98 and in November of 98, counsel for Attorney Selmer moved the referee to order the depositions to which the board had objected. Written argument on this motion followed. However, the referee ultimately granted the board's motion for summary judgment and explicitly declined to reach Attorney Selmer's motion to authorize depositions. Now, these materials are all in the record and in our appendix. I have to note apologetically, I discovered this morning that in my appendix, I misnumbered two of these items with respect to the record. The June 3rd letter is actually record 24, not 23, and the referee's report is actually record 27, not 26, and I apologize for that mistake. I think that there were a couple of different versions of the index, and I must have used the wrong one in compiling my appendix, but the documents are accurate. Both the referee's report and the board's brief discuss at length the facts surrounding discovery attempts, objections, and scheduling problems, and both justify the referee's refusal to extend discovery by the apparent lateness of appellant's motion to extend time for discovery on November 5, 1998. But both, the referee's report and recommendation and the board's brief, both omit a simple and, we contend, critical component of this aspect of the case. On June 3, 1998, appellant's counsel had asked for an extension of the discovery period. After proposing depositions of Randall Lentz, F. Chet Baylor, and Patrick Burns, all of whom appellant believed and believes to have important personal knowledge regarding the Minnesota proceedings pertinent to defense of reciprocal discipline, appellant's counsel noted, quote, upon your stipulation, that is, upon board stipulation, I request referee Jenkins then to execute and return the enclosed order and notices of deposition. If you object, I request referee Jenkins then to schedule argument and toll the discovery calendar pending resolution. The November motion, in effect, renewed the June request, which the referee had not yet addressed, and did so prior to the referee's action on the board's dispositive motion, which by then was pending. This scenario does not justify the ultimate denial of Attorney Selmer's claimed right to depose Lentz, Taylor, and Burns. The referee should have addressed the appellant's request and discovery motion and should have granted it. This court should now remand the matter with directions to do so. The second narrow question is this. Did the board establish as a matter of law that no further proceedings are required to apply the standards for reciprocal discipline set forth in SCR 22.255 A, B, and C? The first narrow issue that I discussed a moment ago can be understood from the procedural history of this case, and this court can decide this case on that issue, remand for additional discovery. This second narrow issue cannot be understood without reference to the broader contextual issues that I have identified, even though the referee's report and recommendation essentially ignores those larger issues. To reiterate, those issues are race and prosecutorial conduct. The referee analyzed SCR...
Briefly describe the proceeding in Minnesota.
Excuse me?
I said briefly describe proceeding in Minnesota. Was there a hearing?
Yes.
Was there an opportunity to put in witnesses?
Yes.
Opportunity for discovery?
I can't speak to the discovery in that proceeding.
On the face of it, would you say that all the process that was due was given? On the face of it?
On the face of it, I would say so.
So, your objection to looking at a proceeding which on the face of it looks valid and fair, that's what due process is, a fair hearing. You are indicating that there was something that was basically unfair in it, and therefore you should have the opportunity to overthrow that. Is that the basic premise that you're here with?
Yes.
And in this state, you are entitled to discovery.
I'm sorry, I can't quite hear you.
I'm sorry. Your client had the opportunity for discovery in this proceeding.
We had an opportunity. The question of our ability to depose three individuals was not fully worked out.
Well, there was a time period in which to have discovery, right?
Yes.
And your client did not request discovery or even ask for an extension within that time period. Is that right? I mean, I want to just make sure I understand the facts.
I hope that I'm answering you candidly so far, and I'll continue to be candid, and the answer to your last question is no. That is to say, let me get my yeses and noes right.
Well,
the request was made
within the
time period because it was made in June.
I'm reading from the referee's report. Respondent had the opportunity to develop his defense. The scheduling order entered herein provided a 2-month time period for discovery. Respondent did not request additional time for discovery, nor did he seek the referee's assistance in completing discovery until more than 3 months after the discovery cutoff. Is that right?
That is what the report and recommendation recites, but I believe that's an error.
Okay.
What I have attempted to present to you is that a request to extend that rather short 2-month window and... recall that 2-month window came out of the initial telephonic conference setting up the preliminary calendar. Shortly thereafter, appellant asked that if there was going to be a problem getting the discovery he wanted, that period be extended, that the limit be told.
So this is a defect in the referee's report.
I believe it is. I believe that the referee simply overlooked the June 3rd request.
And you think this is a crucial issue?
Yes.
Okay. I'm just trying. Now, what are the other errors in her report that you think are crucial? Anything else?
I don't think there's anything else that is as simply mistaken as that point. We disagree with conclusions, but... I believe that the referee simply overlooked a piece of paper. in making that statement, and I don't think there's anything else quite like that in the report.
Mr. Herrick, what was the purpose of the discovery being requested?
To explore the prosecutorial conduct in Minnesota.
And to claim that that was improper in some way?
To document or validate or support appellant's belief that it was improper, yes.
Was there an issue of that nature raised before the Minnesota Supreme Court? In other words, was there a claim that the prosecutor did something wrong? Was that issue raised before the Minnesota Supreme Court?
I'm sorry, I don't know. I do know that much of appellant's concern and opinion about this derived from information that came to his attention later, but I can't answer that question.
Counsel, page 5 of your brief says that you don't dispute the evidentiary facts of record. Does that make reference to the evidentiary facts in this record, or also and or the evidentiary facts of record in the Minnesota proceeding?
This record. And that statement intends to reserve concerns about inferences drawn from facts.
And indeed it does. It goes on to say that you, there are inferences or conclusions that you do perhaps have objection to.
The referee analyzed our rule, SCR 22.255, coolly, as if race were not a factor in the case, as if the frivolousness charged against Attorney Selmer was some unspecified but standard form of legalistic malfeasance, rather than a personal defense claim of racial discrimination. This coolness of the referee is reminiscent to me of the infamous brand of majestic legal neutrality, which prohibits the poor and the rich alike from sleeping under the bridge and from stealing bread. It is a good thing for decision makers to try to be neutral, but it is a treacherous course for an institution of white people to decide after the fact that defensive allegations of racism were frivolous when there was no trial of the underlying facts. This is a slippery ground for the referee to stand on while declining to reach the request for discovery and reaching for the conclusion that the standards of SCR 22.255 have been met. We contend that the racial component of this case justifies certain adjustments. We do not contend that appellant's racial identity as an African American somehow licenses improper conduct, including, for example, frivolous claims. We contend simply that appellant's perceptions and allegations of racial bias deserve careful attention and full scrutiny. We would all be naive to pretend that racial questions carry no special baggage and pose no special problems. If an appropriate sensitivity to the substance of this case is maintained, the application of SCR 22.255 A and B is clear enough. The case for summary judgment has not been made. Sufficient doubt exists under 22.255A as to the fairness of appellant's opportunity to be heard on the subject of racism. The proof is infirm, in the words of the statute, or sufficiently infirm under 22.255B to entitle appellant to proceed. Please recall, he is not seeking vindication, merely a hearing. Similarly, the tests of 22.255, especially at C, must be considered in the context of the broader contextual challenge to the Minnesota prosecution. Appellant believes and alleges that he was ambushed, and he seeks to establish that the prosecution so exceeded the bounds followed in Wisconsin that a similar penalty would not have been imposed.
He's been twice subject to professional discipline in Minnesota. Am I correct about that?
I believe that's correct.
This is his third time?
Yes.
Is that also correct in regard to Wisconsin, that he's been disciplined in Wisconsin previously?
I believe reciprocally on the same facts, yes.
Once a public reprimand, once a private reprimand?
I believe so.
Mr. Perry.
When we start counting, of course, remember that these events preceded in time the second of the Minnesota prosecutions. Excuse me, Justice.
You spoke of the letter requesting that depositions be taken, the letter to the referee. Could you explain to me exactly what you wanted the referee to do, what Mr. Selmer wanted the referee to do when she got that letter?
Yes, and I need to point out that letter, the June 3rd letter, is actually formally addressed to board counsel.
Now, that's in your appendix, and let's just look at that in the appendix. It's appendix page unnumbered, but it's three from the back in the blue brief. And that's why I questioned you about... This is addressed to Mr. Weigel. It's a carbon copy to Ms. Jenkins. I was trying to find it in the record, and at least in my fast look, I could not find it. It may be filed out of chronological order, which is why I could not find it. But
I believe it's number 24.
Okay. Now look, that's where you talked about 24 and 25. All right. Where in that letter, Justice Prosser, you were asking a question. Go ahead.
What is the referee supposed to do exactly? And I want to get to the point of whether the referee had the authority to do what you wanted her to do. But please explain it to me. I don't quite get it.
This letter is a follow-up to the telephonic conference in which we laid out a rather condensed discovery schedule. Realistically, I think if there had been stipulation, we might have been able to get the discovery in within that window. And that's the basis on which the window was agreed to or set up under the telephonic conference.
The stipulation between
board counsel, counsel for appellant, and the referee. I mean, those were the parties to the conference. It was in effect a scheduling conference. And
these three, or who would have the authority to require the prosecutor and the other folks from Minnesota to submit the deposition?
Well, that's a question that we didn't quite reach. We didn't get past the question of whether we had agreement in Wisconsin to conduct those depositions. If the board had said yes, then we were asking the referee to sign the order authorizing us to proceed with those depositions. At that point, the appellant would have had the problem of determining how to get service, basically, in Minnesota on those three individuals. I believe that the three of them are all Minnesota residents. Let's assume they were. So we may have had a procedural problem at that point in obtaining either service or jurisdiction for those depositions. And possibly they would have been resisted, aside from just the formalities. I don't know the answer to that question. What we wanted from board counsel was stipulation allowing us to proceed, in which case the referee we would have asked to approve the stipulation in order, and we would have then proceeded. In the absence of that, a stipulation, what we wanted was, wait a minute, give us a chance. We can't do this in 2 months if we don't have an agreement to do it. And that's the final sentence of this letter, anticipating, because Mr. Weigel had made no, board counsel had made no commitment, he'd been candid about that, we didn't know what his position was going to be, so anticipating that he might object, We said, please then schedule argument on this problem and toll the discovery calendar while we resolve it. There was no question that we would have needed more than the 2 months in the absence of a stipulation.
Did he object?
Yes.
And did you request that schedule argument and toll the discovery calendar?
Well, I regarded the that request to have been made in the June 3rd letter. It is, if you object, I request Referee Jenkins then to schedule argument and toll the discovery calendar.
She did not.
She did not.
She ever respond on that issue?
Not until the report and recommendation.
Was she ever notified by anyone?
Subsequent to the June 3rd letter?
That there was no stipulation that was going to be made.
I'm confident that there was a letter from board counsel to that effect. I know I received such. I can't, without rummaging, I can't cite you to it in the record. But board counsel was candid and prompt in responding to that request, and I'm sure that that's in the record. And, of course, we renewed our concern and our request subsequently by motion in November.
And what?
And that's the motion that the referee refers to in the report and recommendation.
What, I know you don't know until you get discovery, but what did you expect or hope to learn from these depositions? I mean, you take depositions because you have a theory about information that might be available, questions you might ask that would be a smoking gun, right? Just not on a fishing expedition, theoretically.
Well, I have multiple difficulties in responding to your question. One is it requires me to go, I think, beyond the record, at least beyond what I can cite in the record. And it requires me to discuss matters that we've done some investigation on and have some preliminary ideas about. I want to answer that question as much as I can. We expected to find
evidence of racial discrimination.
Yes, and more specifically, evidence of questionable prosecutorial practices in preparing for this Minnesota case and in the relationship between this Minnesota case and previous cases and parties to the previous cases.
Thank you. That's a sufficient enough answer. And similar to one you gave before.
Oh, I'm glad of that.
Your red light is on if you want a concluding sentence or two. Take it, and you have time for rebuttal.
Let me do literally a sentence, and it's not an especially long sentence. We believe still that this case should be decided narrowly. And we believe that in the light cast by the broader issues, or perhaps I should say in the shadow of the broader issues, the narrow decision should favor the appellant.
Thank you, Mr. Herring. You have several minutes for a rebuttal, Mr. Weigel. Weigel? Which is it? I'm sorry, I keep that. Mr. Weigel. Representing the Board of Attorneys' Professional Responsibility.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court, Mr. Herrick. My name is Bill Weigel. I am representing the Board in this matter. I'd like to take the opportunity to this morning to discuss four topics with the Court. Number one, the Minnesota proceedings. Number two, the reciprocal discipline rule. Number three, the issues related to summary judgment. And number four, the discovery issues now raised by appellant. Conversance with these first two topics, the nature and extent of the Minnesota proceedings and the structure of the reciprocal discipline rule, are necessary to get to what this appeal is really about, which are rulings related to summary judgment and discovery. Mr. Selmer, who had received professional discipline on two prior occasions in Minnesota and two prior occasions in Wisconsin, the second of which was the same, I believe, case, a reciprocal discipline case, was charged there in Minnesota with engaging in a pattern of harassing and frivolous litigation, with making false and misleading statements, discovery requests, and in pretrial proceedings, and other misconduct. Mr. Selmer was ably represented in Minnesota, and his defense was exhaustive. After pretrial motions and briefing, the matter proceeded to hearing. Minnesota's system is not identical, but it is similar to ours. That Supreme Court appointed to act as referee in that hearing, District Court Judge Harlan Nelson. And Judge Nelson, acting as referee Nelson, presided over a contested four-day hearing. At that hearing, 15 witnesses were heard from. At that hearing, there were some 194 exhibits, over 120 of which were offered by Mr. Selmer. Mr. Selmer himself certainly had ample opportunity to be heard in Minnesota. His testimony between direct and cross comprises 300 pages of the Minnesota hearing transcript. Importantly, I believe this was asked of Mr. Herrick, the issue of appellant's perception of racial discrimination and the issue of whether the Minnesota director somehow utilized improper strategy by allegedly waiting to file these charges and ambush Mr. Selmer, those are both issues that were raised in Minnesota even at the hearing stage. The Minnesota referee issued a report containing its findings of fact, conclusions of law, legal analysis, consideration of aggravating and mitigating factors, his recommendation for discipline. The report was long. It extensively referenced the record and provided sufficient support for his findings and his recommendation. Mr. Selmer appealed from the Minnesota report, as was his right. He was ably represented on appeal, and his appeal was exhaustive. I believe his 144-page initial brief and appendix cited some 70 cases in addition to other authorities. Yeah. Filed a reply brief. There were amicus briefs filed in the matter.
And you had this total record, and is it part of this?
This is part of the record by virtue of the briefs in Minnesota being made part of the record. I believe they're listed record number 24 exhibits, but they're attachments to my affidavit, the board's affidavit in support of the motion for judgment.
But the record itself of Minnesota is not here.
The entire hearing transcript in Minnesota is part of this record in Wisconsin.
That's what I'm trying to get at. That is part of it. What about the appeals briefs in Minnesota? Is that part of the record?
Part of the record would be Mr. Selmer's appellate brief and appendix that he filed, the OLPR, Office of Lawyer Professional Responsibility in Minnesota's appellate brief, and Mr. Selmer's reply brief.
Okay.
Those are all part of this record by virtue of having been included with my affidavit in support for the motion for judgment, which was given to referee Jenkins so she could understand the depth and breadth and multifaceted aspect and opportunities that Mr. Selmer had in Minnesota. And in that appeal, as the appellate briefs will show, he left no stone unturned. I believe that Justice Prosser, or one of the justices, had asked about whether or not the issue of whether the director knew of the charges, the prosecutorial misconduct issue, whether the director knew of the charges before Hand was raised to the Minnesota Supreme Court. And yes, it was. If one looks at the appellate brief filed by Mr. Selmer in Minnesota, the table of contents are the Minnesota director did this, and the Minnesota director knew of this before probation was imposed, and he shouldn't be allowed to do this. And that was certainly not the only thing argued, but something that was addressed by Mr. Selmer and determined adverse to him after consideration by the Minnesota Supreme Court. Now, Mr. Selmer had argued race. He had argued prosecutorial strategy. There was a motion to dismiss before the hearing, even. You know, in short, Mr. Selmer had and seized the opportunity to be heard there and had truly his full day in court in Minnesota where he practiced law. But the Minnesota court considered the briefs and issued an opinion suspending his license for 12 months. The court found a theme that the appellant repeatedly and improperly asserted racial discrimination as a sword or a shield to thwart legitimate collection efforts of debts he admitted he owed. The Minnesota court further specifically found J. Just as the record demonstrates a pattern of frivolous and harassing litigation, a second pattern of misconduct also emerges, one characterized by repeated misrepresentation, nondisclosure, and lack of candor. Importantly, the Minnesota court referenced Judge or Referee Nelson's finding that Mr. Selmer was provided with a panoply of due process protections. And Minnesota court, I believe, referenced, certainly the referee referenced, that included Minnesota discovery, access to the prosecution file, hearing, entitlement to cross-examination, and, of course, the right of review. And the Supreme Court did review that record in Minnesota, and they stated, "Our review of the record shows that the prosecution proved by clear and convincing evidence that appellant engaged in misconduct by asserting the frivolous claims, by offering evidence he knew to be false, by not complying properly with other discovery, knowingly making a false statement, and just generally engaging in conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice." Now, an understanding of that procedural history, and I thank the court for its patience in listening to that, I think is a very important underpinning with which to understand and analyze the instant reciprocal discipline action and what brought us here today. And talking about that action...
Well, where in the record would it show if there was racial bias?
Sorry, I didn't hear your question.
So where on the record would there be a showing of racial bias? I mean, you ordinarily would not get it on the record. Occasionally you've got smoking gun, but it's rare.
Well, my understanding of the Minnesota proceedings is that Mr. Selmer was charged with harassing and frivolous litigation, with making these charges, with having no basis, in fact, for them. And he was charged disciplinarily in Minnesota. The entire process took place, and he had the opportunity at hearing. I don't know the details of the Minnesota discovery. I have to presume that there was some discovery to produce whatever evidence he may have had, whatever arrows may have been in his quiver that would have allowed him to make these charges.
Did he raise the race issue there?
He raised the race issue in Minnesota. In fact, the Minnesota referees report, which is part of the board's complaint and an exhibit to the referees, to the Wisconsin referees report, used as a mitigating factor Mr. Selmer's perception of his racial identity and how that affected his behavior and conduct. SCR 2225, which is what this case was brought upon here in Wisconsin, is the reciprocal discipline rule. I think the court has it available to it, but it's set forth in its entirety on page 2 of the board's red jacketed brief. Basically, it provides for prompt imposition of identical discipline unless the disciplined attorney shows that the other state's proceeding or result is fundamentally unfair. More specifically, that rule mandates that the Wisconsin referee issue a report recommending identical discipline unless one of three specific articulated exceptions are shown. They're found in SCR 2225, sub 5, A, B, and C. Those exceptions, I'll use the word exceptions perhaps several times in the remainder of the time available to me, are that A, there was, I don't have the rule in front of me, but the Minnesota proceeding was so lacking in notice and opportunity to be heard as to constitute a deprivation of due process. B, that the proof in Minnesota was just incredibly infirm and the referee couldn't accept as final those conclusions. Or C, that misconduct established in Minnesota would justify substantially different discipline here in Wisconsin. The rule does not anticipate relitigation of the underlying disciplinary proceedings. The proceedings under the rule enjoy, a presumptive validity, and the practical necessity of an expedited reciprocal discipline rule is evident. To hold otherwise would force a relitigation of already tried matters. It would place a tremendous and an expensive burden on this state's disciplinary resources. But I'm not going to stand here, and the board is not asking the court to decide this case on expediency. Rather, having talked about the Minnesota proceedings, a bit about the reciprocal discipline rule, our attention should be turned to what the case is really about. Is Referee Jenkins' ruling or rulings proper? In other words, based on the record before her, should she have granted summary judgment? And I would submit the answer to that is yes, her ruling was proper. She certainly should have. Civil rules of procedure, including summary judgment, are available and applicable to disciplinary proceedings. board showed entitlement, I believe summary judgment statutes 802.08, by making a proper and ample showing that that they were entitled. And appellant's response, which included no affidavits and no oppositional evidence, was simply insufficient. It did not set forth specific facts showing there was a genuine issue for trial. The whole state of the record at that point in Wisconsin rendered the grant and ultimate grant of summary judgment appropriate. The record had been that the board filed a disciplinary complaint. Appellant admitted to all of the material factual allegations, admitted to all the exhibits appended to the complaint. At that point, the only thing in the way of the referee's prompt issuance of a report recommending identical discipline was appellant's, I'll say, pro forma articulation of his entitlement to these three exceptions. Don't impose reciprocal discipline right away. I'm entitled to these three exceptions. So discovery was propounded. Interrogatories and requests for documents were sent to appellant to put him to his proof, to say, give every item and every argument you have to show that you might be entitled to the benefit of these three exceptions and should not have immediate imposition of reciprocal discipline. A discovery response was received. Those are also part of the record. Those were provided with my affidavit in support of the board's ultimate motion for judgment. The discovery response, when taken point by point, was just clearly inviable and inadequate as a matter of law to establish entitlement to the protections or exceptions of 2225-5. So the board brought a motion for judgment. The board supported it, including the discovery, including the Minnesota hearing transcript, some of the briefs as I had referenced. The board's motion was further supported by a point-by-point memorandum discussing each of the items indicated by appellant in his discovery response and the inadequacy of them to bring him within the exceptions to the reciprocal discipline rule. And I believe that those, in the referee's report exhibits, that those attachments to that support allowed her to understand the breadth and opportunities given to Mr. Selmer in Minnesota and allowed her to establish the propriety of judgment. But there was a response. Mr. Selmer did file a response to the motion for summary judgment, but he did not file any oppositional affidavits. He did not bring any new evidence to the table. In fact, he specifically indicated in his response there is no need to add to the board's submissions. Now, I'd like leave to discuss the discovery issue. It is an important one, and the court has taken time with it with Mr. Herrick, but I'll point out that nowhere in the brief in opposition to summary judgment did Mr. Selmer argue that his response to the board's motion for judgment was incomplete due to some perceived need to conduct discovery. Rather, the submission made it clear that what Mr. Selmer wanted was a retrial of the Minnesota case, a retrial of the underlying cases which brought forth the Minnesota charges. He wanted our referee to determine the credibility and good faith of those Minnesota witnesses. You know, in short, he didn't like the way that Judge Nelson decided the facts and law, or the way the Minnesota Supreme Court decided the facts or the law. While he articulated that disagreement, he did not bring forth anything material showing that he was entitled to the exceptions of 2225. The board filed a memorandum, which is relatively brief. It's on the issue of summary judgment. That's a prime issue before the court. The reply memorandum of the board is probably only about 6 pages, unlike some of the briefs I unfortunately tend to file, and I guess it's R17. I'd recommend it to the court on the issue of summary judgment. And the referee Jenkins then issued her report. She said there was no genuine issue of material fact. The board is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. But what the referee did not do is she didn't rubber stamp the board's submission. She analyzed the motion and the affidavit and the submissions. She verified the lack of submission on the part of appellant. She found, as Chief Justice pointed out, that the appellant had the opportunity to develop his defense. She found he had the opportunities to make arguments during the Minnesota proceedings. She specifically stated there's no evidence that appellant was prevented in any way from presenting exculpatory or other evidence in Minnesota, and nothing in the record showed a denial of due process or infirmity of proof in Minnesota. Her reasoning was sound, and based on the record before her, the grant of summary judgment was proper.
Mr. Weigel, Mr. Herrick's brief asks that we remand this matter to the referee. I assume from what you just said, you disagree with that. And that your brief in the conclusion urges that we issue an order identical, reciprocal discipline. Tell me what that order will say precisely, in your opinion, should say precisely.
What your opinion should say?
Yeah. What the order should say. That he is what? Suspended from practice?
That upon review of the certified copy of the disciplinary order of the Minnesota Supreme Court, having assigned the matter to referee Janet Jenkins, she having conducted proceedings in this matter and determined, obviously more detailed,
right.
but made certain determinations that...
Right, and that she was right on the law and she was right, that her
right
facts
on the law
are not
she's right on the facts,
clearly erroneous.
That that's appropriate.
Okay.
That you declined to overturn her on appeal and that you ultimately believe should issue an opinion consistent with the Minnesota opinion.
Okay, what is that? Tell me what the Minnesota opinion is and what the time period you're asking for.
In Minnesota, Mr. Selmer was suspended for a period of 12 months.
From when to when?
I believe the commencement date of the 12-month suspension would have been September 25th of 1997. Thereabouts.
Till, okay, roughly. October 1, 1998. Is he now practicing in Minnesota? Is
he
now
not
licensed?
That's not part of the record, Chief Justice. He's not now practicing in Minnesota. I'm not aware that he has not filed a petition for reinstatement.
So he's still out of Minnesota. Now, what are we going to do? What do you suggest? Are we going to suspend it? What did he practice in Wisconsin from September 97 to October 98?
I don't know if he practiced in Wisconsin during that time period. I know that it, again, this is not part of the record, just so that the court is clear, that he happens to be suspended from the practice of law in Wisconsin at this point for non-payment of dues since November of 98.
He has not paid his dues. That's a matter of record.
Pardon me?
He has not paid his dues as of November 1998, so now he is not practicing here anyway. So what year do we suspend him? What 12 months is that?
Well, the board had requested the imposition of a 12-month suspension, and I think the court generally does that progressively rather than retroactively, absent some type of agreement to the contrary. There have not been any discussions with regard to any agreement to the contrary. I have to leave that to the sound discretion of the court.
Okay, but you expected from, I assume, now, we've had these issues before, from now on.
Connection with my limited experience in reciprocal discipline, I would expect it to run from now on.
And what if someone has practices while they're under suspension in another state, and you know that it's brought to your attention that one, he's suspended, and two, he's practicing in Wisconsin. What do you do then? What does the board do?
No, the board investigates the matter. I mean, it determines whether there's really clear and convincing evidence of whether or not the person was practicing well under suspension. And if there is, I mean, the investigator it's the process of the board. The investigator looks at case law or precedent or what the court has done in prior matters, brings it to our board. The administrator makes a recommendation, and our board says, yes, that was misconduct. Weigel, we want you to file an action and ask for 90 days, or we think this is a private reprimand, or whatever direction the board gives, our agency takes.
I didn't look at the rules. Is there a rule if you're suspended in another state, you're not supposed to practice here?
If you're an attorney here, I don't believe there's any reason you would not be able to practice here, but I have some unfamiliarity with the rules.
All right, I can check it out.
Not an attorney. Our rules, of course, only apply to attorneys here. We don't have that kind of UPL, unauthorized practice of law rule.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the answer to one of the questions. Are you saying that if an attorney is suspended here or revoked here, the person cannot, let's say suspended here, cannot practice in another state?
I don't believe that's true, and I am sorry that I can't pull out rules or cases. If think dual driver's license are allowed. If I have a Colorado driver's license and a Wisconsin driver's license, for some reason I lose one or the other, right? Absent reciprocity, where my other state's privileges are also gained, I think that I should be entitled to drive in that other state. I think that while Mr. Selmer is suspended in Minnesota, I believe he would be entitled to practice law in Wisconsin. However, he had a duty, and he did, notify us of the Minnesota suspension, at which point our agency investigates the reciprocal discipline issues.
I had asked the other way. If he was suspended in Minnesota, can we practice here? But same kind of, okay, I can look that up. I think that's covered somewhere. I'm sorry to have interrupted you, but I gather then that you would want suspension from whatever the date of the order is close there to in Wisconsin.
I would want a 12-month suspension, and I guess that issue as to the commencement date hadn't been addressed, and that truly is within the discretion of the court. And I would, not sure how much time may or may not be remaining, continue our discussion by discussing the discovery issue if the court would like to entertain further argument on that.
Just one other question here. I take it Mr. Selmer is eligible to practice in Minnesota as of today. As of September 11th of 1998.
My best to answer that. In Wisconsin, if one is suspended for 6 months or more, rather than being automatically entitled to reinstatement upon the filing of an affidavit and the running of the time, you have to, as the court knows, you have to petition for reinstatement and go through the entire process. I believe Minnesota's process is the same or very similar. And it's, again, my understanding, Mr. Selmer is not licensed in Minnesota. Petitioned for reinstatement of his license, and he must so petition and have that granted prior to being able to practice law. I don't think he could take a drive to Minneapolis today and show up in traffic court.
I would like to talk to you, if you're done with this aspect, talk to you about the letter in June and the request of tolling the time period under the discovery calendar. That letter went to you, and did you write Mr. Herrick and say, I'm not stipulating?
Mr. Herrick sent his letter of June 3rd, and I think the precedent to that is the referee has a May 18th scheduling order, which clearly says discovery ends July 20th. It was completed on or before. I wrote back within 2 weeks and indicated the board would not join his request for these depositions, absent some showing of the materiality of the proposed testimony. My letter is a part of the
A
copy of my letter was sent to the referee, that's correct.
All right. It's okay, we can find it in the record.
And if I had my record in front of me and was able to find it, it would be one of the last couple of items on the amended record index. It was one of the last three or four add-ons. It's called Weigel's June 15th, 98 letter, some such. And after that point, no steps were taken by Mr. Selmer or counsel to do anything about discovery for quite some time. My letter, by the way, not only said I'm not going to join in the depositions, it said these are Minnesota folks, or more properly, I believe it said, with regard to the Minnesota prosecutor, my understanding is they're going to take the position that they'll oppose that request to compel testimony, and you're going to have to get a Ramsey County, Minnesota subpoena. Now, not only didn't appellant try to schedule or pursue that matter before the referee prior to the discovery deadline, he did not take any steps to pursue that in Minnesota. He did not make any motion to amend the scheduling order. As previously mentioned, the board files a motion for judgment, and in his response to that motion for judgment, he didn't say, man, my response is just incomplete because I can't do it without discovery. That issue was not raised until November 3rd, 3.5 months after the discovery deadline, 2.5 months after the board filed its motion, several weeks after all the briefing is completed on that motion. But I'm not telling this court that it should necessarily say, you know, you're too late, you didn't protect your rights, you didn't do what you should under the discovery deadline, and for that reason alone, you're simply out of luck. Because we're not asking the court to decide this case on necessarily a technicality. I think that should there be error, it's perhaps harmless error also, but Referee Jenkins did meet these issues. When Mr. Herrick brought his motion to authorize discovery, pursuant to his request, Referee Jenkins said, okay, I'm going to give you guys an expedited briefing schedule. I want to hear why this discovery is important. And Mr. Selmer, or Mr. Herrick, in your brief, I want you to tell me and address the issue of untimeliness or its summary judgment motion, but I want you to tell me what's material about these three proponents. I want you to do it with some degree of specificity. And indeed, that something was submitted then by appellant supporting his motion for discovery, requesting that discovery be had. And quite frankly, what was submitted was just insufficient. And much of it didn't seem to relate to this disciplinary case or this Minnesota disciplinary case. The board filed its response, and both Mr. Herrick's brief in support of discovery and the board response are both parts of the record sheet, which I've unfortunately lost. But I believe that this brief would be record number 20. He supplemented that with a further letter to the referee, number 21, and I filed number 22, which is my responsive brief. And I said, look, the stuff he said just doesn't in any way entitle him to the benefit of these 22.25 sub 5 E through C exceptions. So in sum, the discovery may have been extraordinarily late, and there may have been inadequate steps taken to protect any right to discovery. But I'm also reminding the court that despite the opportunity to support it, there's nothing in the record to render it plausible the discovery motion would have or should have been granted. I feel that Mr. Selmer would have liked the discovery to engage on a fishing expedition. And for that reason, this case should not be remanded to the referee. I haven't much addressed the issue of discipline because I believe there's very little or nothing in the record to show that the discipline should be substantially different than that which was imposed in Minnesota. Mr. Selmer did assert multiple grounds groundless claims, I guess I should say, of racial discrimination. The referee made the comment in her report that lawyers are repeatedly criticized for engaging in baseless litigation, and his conduct legitimizes some of that criticism. And it was an abuse of his license to practice law. And moreover, there's other conduct that exhibited to the Minnesota Supreme Court a clear pattern of dishonesty. And I certainly would argue to the court that no less than a 12-month suspension is warranted. I guess I'd respectfully urge this court to issue an opinion finding that the motion for summary judgment grant was proper, that the discovery issue does not render that grant improper, and order that Mr. Selmer's Wisconsin law license be suspended for 12 months, and that he be ordered to pay the costs of the proceeding here. In conclusion,
how much are the costs, do you know, as of today?
Pardon me?
How much are the costs? I saw a bill in here.
I don't know and don't have any way of telling you. The costs would be gauged at Referee Jenkins' rate of between $30 and $35 an hour, I believe is what the per diem rate works out to. Because of the time that this action was started, the cost for my time would be something like $36 or $38 an hour, something less than $40 an hour. This is not my entire file. There are big, fat, brown files at the office, and a lot of time was put into this, but the costs aren't figured. Unless I filed a statement of costs.
I'm just some statement in there, but that's okay. All right.
Well, that plus the appellate time involved in preparation for today.
And BAPR has decided to charge their counsel's costs. You're an employee of BAPR.
Well, BAPR, if, let's say, Mr. Basting had been prosecuting the action, pays him $60 and then asks that we be allowed to charge the respondent $60. If Elsa Green or Bill Weigel or somebody on staff had prosecuted the action, we would charge a reduced amount based upon salary. But it was decided that didn't take anything into full consideration. And to be consistent amongst all respondents, not to up the amount we can charge, but just so we're not charging respondent A $60 an hour and respondent B $40 an hour, it was determined that it was supportable to request reimbursement at $60 an hour. That happens for cases, we're doing that for cases filed after like March 22nd of this year. In this case, I think it was filed.
That was a board action, if I remember the minutes.
I'm trying to recall if that was an open or closed item. I believe it was an open item, and that would have been a board action.
I don't have access to the closed minutes. Thank you.
Chief, may I ask a question? The Constitution provides in Article 4, United States Constitution Article 4, full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. Does that have any application to these reciprocal discipline matters?
Every state has a little bit different spin on their disciplinary rules, and there are model rules. And it would appear that a number of states have rules which say conclusion of misconduct in the foreign state will be conclusive evidence of misconduct in this state. It would appear that some of these states, Minnesota included, say, bring the foreign state's conduct to us, and we'll basically issue an order to show cause in 30 days why we shouldn't do the exact same thing. And so in that way, they're giving, and I'm not a sufficient constitutional scholar to be able to say full faith and credit, I guess I call it at least presumptive validity to the other state's proceeding, absent some horrendous and unfair defect. I guess I am asking the court to give faith and credit to the Minnesota Supreme Court's determinations in this matter.
Mr. Weigel, are there any other questions? Mr. Weigel, thank you very much. Mr. Herrick, several minutes in rebuttal.
I find some difficulty balancing the problem of what to do with those couple thousand pages of record from Minnesota. I think they're in the record here for a limited purpose, to show that there were proceedings in Minnesota. I responded to the chief's question early on that there was some kind of facial process there that we're not disputing. And I don't think that the Minnesota record really does much more than confirm that.
Confirm what?
That there were full Minnesota...